The internet can get you into a lot of trouble. Just ask a former Massachusetts Air National Guardsman. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 5, Episode 12 of the Real Spies, Real Lives podcast. This is where we talk about writing spies and writing about spies. I'm your host, espionage author P.A. Duncan. When I was researching my series, A Perfect Hatred, where I delved into the extreme right-wing here in America, I found lots of surprises. Not that there was an extreme white supremacist, anti-government, anti-Semitic movement in this country. I grew up in rural Virginia. I knew it was there. It was an almost everyday thing. Indeed, this movement, if you want to call it that, stretches back to post-revolution in this country. As soon as we set up this new government, there were people who were against it, and not just the British. The outcome of the Civil War exacerbated this. Government granting of rights to black people and women further fueled it. It may have reached its heyday when a U.S. National Socialist organization held a pro-Nazi rally in, of all places, Madison Square Garden in New York City, just before World War II. After World War II, though, this insanity subsided, but it didn't go away. It went underground, off the grid, you might say. And the problem with that, or maybe what was good about that, is that the various like-minded groups couldn't easily communicate with each other. The U.S. Postal Service was suspect because it was part of the government. Couriers were a good solution, but then their messages could get intercepted by those dreaded federal agents. Then some enterprising right-wing nutjob found shortwave radio. Not only could these groups broadcast messages to each other, in code, of course, via shortwave, they could also reach people who hadn't heard their warped message before. Fast forward a few decades, and these groups, made and distributed usually by hand on street corners or at rallies, newsletters, and pamphlets on a variety of right-wing issues. All false, but written in an emotionally wrenching way to appeal to people's fears, real or imagined. Fast forward a bit more to the beginning of the public internet and the AOL chat rooms. I know these places existed, and the right-wingers used them, because I created a fake username and joined them to further my research into A Perfect Hatred. In the meantime, AM radio, which was rapidly losing its audience, saw this trend and opened its slots to a host of extreme right-wing talk show hosts, some of whom created television programs and broadcast them through public access channels. A few of these were even picked up briefly by mainstream media. The fax machine, too, became an effective way for these groups to spread hate. The internet evolved, and along came social media, where such individuals and groups could come together to spew their hatred and, most importantly to them, recruit more followers. The virulence of this action meant people who didn't want to see hate messages or be recruited complained to the social media companies who cracked down on hate speech and promoting violence. Facebook, or Meta as it's branded now, and its affiliated companies use an algorithm to detect abusive content, but sometimes the AI behind that is a little too sensitive. When Twitter became X, suddenly the hate groups that had had their accounts removed or closed down were back, stronger and more hateful than ever. Technology is a two-edged sword here. On one hand, it allows these hate groups to go public and reveal their hateful and regressive natures. Reasonable people will see their spew and be turned off. But on the other hand, unfortunately, a minority for sure will be attracted to it and join in. I've always wanted this country to err on the side of free speech. Let the hate groups talk and show themselves for the narrow-minded cretins they are. Let them march and carry their Nazi and Confederate flags and reveal their ignorance and intolerance. I feel the same way about the internet. However, when it comes to encouraging violence, abusing or exploiting children, fostering human trafficking, and the like, I say, shut them down. If crimes have been committed, arrest the perpetrators and lock them up. I truly do not want to suppress speech of any kind. Again, I believe in giving haters free rein to show who they really are. However, I also want to have the choice for myself to see it or not. Subjecting myself to this garbage for research purposes was thankfully brief, but it left me angry, disillusioned, and somewhat paranoid for a while. But I chose to stop researching. Believe me, I had more than enough for verisimilitude in my fiction. Almost every time now I'm on Twitter, I end up blocking a good number of people who think it's their right to spread their hate on my post. Yes, it's their right, but no, trolls belong under bridges, and I like sending them back there. Right before the pandemic in 2020, a new player in the social media game had emerged, Discord. I have nothing against Discord, I'm going to say that up front. But it was originally aimed at gamers, so they would have a place where they could engage with each other while they played interactively, exchange clues and cues for various games, and it quickly became a place where people could create their own private spaces called servers. Discord, however, requires the administrators of these servers to police what's posted on them. Discord itself doesn't get involved unless they get a complaint about a specific server. The problem being, if you have a bunch of like-minded people on a server, no one is going to complain. And the average person, a normie, as they're called, has to apply to join the server. And if the admins suspect them of being a normie, they don't get approved, or if they have been, they get booted pretty quickly. Now, as a disclaimer, I have used Discord with an online writing group I belong to. We have a server where we do writing sprints and report our results and discuss writing and publishing topics. Because I'm not into gaming, I didn't explore any other servers on Discord, so I had no clue what went on there. Now, granted, a lot, probably most, of the gamer servers are just fine. It's when people took them a step beyond into a, quote, safe place, unquote, for them to spew hatred and foster violence. But last year, a Massachusetts Air National Guardsman was arrested for releasing classified documents, wait for it, on Discord servers. Even though his name is public record now, and 2 weeks ago he pled guilty to the charges against him and accepted a 16-year prison sentence, I'm not going to grant him any more notoriety by using his name. An IT specialist for the Massachusetts Air National Guard, he was granted a security clearance so he could work in a secure facility where he, as an IT geek, happened to have access to classified material. Though this facility was one where you couldn't have your smartphone past a certain point, this guardsman managed to make notes about the classified documents he saw, which he took home, transcribed, and then posted online. He eventually managed to smuggle the actual documents out of the facility, took photos of them at home, and posted the photos online. In fact, he was caught several times mishandling classified material, but was only warned, essentially told, "Don't do that again." The photos he took of the classified documents were then screenshot by others and spread even further. Some of the documents he copied and posted had to do with Russian military movements in Ukraine, and having them posted online meant the Russians now knew what the U.S. and therefore the Ukrainians knew, and they could adjust their tactics accordingly. And of course, Russian hackers are on places like Discord and similar social media things, because they're searching for just that same kind of thing. If you want an in-depth and excellent dive into this incident, including what might have been this Air Guardsman's motivation, look for the PBS Frontline episode entitled "The Discord Leaks." I found it on Amazon Prime, PBS Documentaries channel. After watching it, I was thankful to learn that the commander of that secure facility whose personnel caught the guardsman several times was dismissed from his job and 15 other personnel disciplined for their lax handling of this particular guardsman. The system can work when everyone is paying attention. For me, what was lacking and has hopefully been changed is that when you fill out the inevitable paperwork to obtain a security clearance, there is no blank to fill out regarding your social media presence. This dude was posting classified material for 2 years before he was caught, but if the agency conducting the security clearance, usually the FBI or an FBI contractor, had delved into his social media presence before he was granted clearance, they might have found things that would have nipped this in the bud. But yes, hindsight is always 20/20. And now it's commercial time. It's still March, so my debut mystery novel, Supreme Madness of the Carnival Season, is still on sale for only 99 cents for the ebook. I've had some good sales for it this month and already some page reads on Kindle, so thank you for joining me in celebrating my book's first book birthday. The sale will remain active through March 31st, so I'll put the link to it in the description of this episode. And commercial over. All right, let's read a bit from Supreme Madness. This is from close to the end of the book, and let me set this up a bit. Our protagonist, Marilyn Shook, has just returned from meeting with a woman in Philadelphia who has all the answers Marilyn has been looking for about who put the baby in the wall of her house. And one answer in particular has upended what Marilyn thought had happened. But you're going to have to read the book to find out what that is. Sorry. Not sorry. Right before this trip, Marilyn had discovered that her husband had not stopped his cheating ways after the move to Ewington, and she's kicked him out. She's come home to an empty house. Supreme Madness of the Carnival Season, Part 9, Exciting the Sensitive Soul to Tears, Chapter 45. Monday afternoon, upon her return from Philadelphia, Marilyn came into the kitchen from the garage to find the house quiet and still. On the kitchen table sat a white envelope, thick with pages and inscribed with her name in Hunter's handwriting. Before she opened it, she went through the house. His computer and books were gone from the study. Upstairs in the bedroom, his half of the walk-in closet was bare of his clothes, the bathroom empty of his shaving supplies and other toiletries. She tried to catalog what she felt and found her emotions lacking. She tried to feel something, regret, remorse, anything. Ah, here was something. It felt good not to have to confront him. If he'd been here, it would have been too easy to relent and let him stay, to do what she'd always done, deny his behavior. This time, she wasn't going to relent. Back at the kitchen table, she sat with Hunter's letter before her and a glass of wine at hand. For a while, she soaked in the quiet, the serenity, something she'd never had. She'd had this odd feeling all weekend in Philadelphia, not a feeling that something was missing, not someone missing. Nothing intruded on her personal space. Indeed, she now recognized she'd never had personal space, whether living at home or living with Hunter. Rather, she'd felt herself enlarge, expand to fill the emptiness, as if she'd reclaimed something which had always been hers, but which she'd given away for no reason. Well, it was for love, but did you have to surrender yourself for that? Marilyn pushed the envelope aside, dug in her purse for a business card she'd kept, took the house phone from its charger, and called State Police Sergeant Archie Pember. He listened to her long story, asked plenty of questions, and she could hear him taking notes on his computer. If I can ask, ma'am, why'd you do this? He asked. Because that baby deserved better, Marilyn replied. Yes, yes, he did, Pember said. What are you going to do? Get an official statement from you, ask Ms. Bankhead and Ms. McIntosh a few questions, consult with the Commonwealth attorney, but I doubt anything will come of it. I still want to pay for the baby's funeral. Yes, ma'am, I haven't forgot. I'll put you in touch with the coroner. Miss Shuck, for some reason, you suspected Mrs. McIntosh right away. Why didn't you tell me then? Would you have believed this crazy story then? He laughed softly. Well, probably not. Thank you for being persistent. Good day now. I'll talk to you soon. That done, Marilyn stared at the envelope again, seeing the familiar flourish of Hunter's handwriting. She remembered the first time she'd seen that grandiose scrawl, a short story she'd submitted in his class. He didn't write personal notes on students' work, but he had on hers, effusive praise she had taken to heart. He signed the note Hunter, not Professor Russell. They'd become lovers not long after. Even fortified by the wine, Marilyn still stared at Hunter's envelope for a long time before she opened it. He hadn't sealed it, only tucked the flap inside. She withdrew the folded letter, 6 pages, composed on the computer and printed. Only her name on the first page and a salutation and his name on the last, All My Love, Hunter, were handwritten. Marilyn drank some wine and began to read.
Mar, I'm staying at the Dixie Hotel through the end of the week, or until you come to your senses, whichever comes first. So call me when you get back from Yale. If I don't hear from you by the end of the week, I'm going back to North Carolina. The university never filled my slot, and they'll be happy to give it back to me.
Marilyn supposed that was intended to be a threat. What did he expect her to do? Run over to the Dixie Hotel and fall on her knees to beg him to come back? Of course, that's what he expected. The letter continued.
Mar, I don't really want to do that, and you know that, so it's up to you. I reiterate my sincerest apology and the fact that it had nothing to do with my feelings for you, which are, of course, unchanged. I love you. I reiterate as well my offer to attend marriage counseling. Frankly, I feel that is an option we should explore before you make a rash decision.
She tried to imagine Hunter setting aside his ego to be honest with the therapist. That almost made her laugh. The next part of the letter showed her how futile the marriage counseling exercise would be.
Mar, I've always understood your inferiority complex issues, given, you know, where you came from. But I've overlooked them or developed my own coping mechanisms because I love you. Perhaps now, though, you need to acknowledge these issues yourself, face them, and...
She folded the letter, put it back into the envelope, and shoved it into the trash can. No, that wasn't enough. She fished the envelope from the trash and went into the study where the shredder still sat. Hunter had shredded printed drafts of his novel because he was certain the garbage men would steal his work and plagiarize it. The grinding sound the shredder made while chewing on Hunter's letter was beyond satisfying. Okay, that's enough reading for today. We're now fully into spring, or Ostara, as the Celts called it. Light is conquering darkness, and it's almost time to start planting, except I left the farm a long time ago. Instead of puttering in a garden, I'll take advantage of some warmer weather. But when I'm outside, you know, I'll be keeping an eye out for spies. Maybe even on Discord. The proceeding has been a production of Unexpected Paths Media, copyright 2024, all rights reserved. Join us next week for a new episode of the Real Spies, Real Lives podcast. And, as always, Slava Ukraini!